Welcome to Asia Calling, your window on Asia. This week, we bring you good news and bad. Sadly, this is the last episode of Asia Calling. After broadcasting incredible stories from across Asia for 14 years, we're coming to a close. But the good news is that we have a fantastic final episode in store for you. Some of our long-standing reporters look back over particularly powerful moments of reporting in the region, revisiting stories that have shaped them and the most inspiring voices that they've brought to the airwaves. We also have a very unique audio diary from an Indonesian woman living in Central Australia, learning an Aboriginal language. And we hear from the people that have made all of this possible over the years, some of Asia Calling's past editors. Stay with us for this special last program. Thanks for tuning into the show. I'm Nicole Kirby. In many parts of Australia, Indigenous language and culture has been destroyed by colonisation. But in the desert town of Alice Springs, Central Australia, Aboriginal culture remains fairly strong. Dina Indrasafitri is learning the language of the Arendt people who have lived in Alice Springs for tens of thousands of years.
Hi, my name is Dina. I'm Indonesian and I'm living in Alice Springs. Most people just call it Alice, a desert town right in the center of Australia. It's a beautiful place, surrounded by big, picturesque ochre ranges and hills that look like fortresses surrounding the town. I'm learning Aranda language. It's the language spoken by the original inhabitants of Alice Springs.
Ndakanairama? Ndakanairama? What's happening? Or like, what's up, maybe? And
almost everyone here speaks English. But I think it makes sense to learn the language of the place I'm living in. After all, I've always had more respect for foreigners who try to speak Indonesian when they are in Indonesia.
And I think this is really good. We talk about... Oh, thank you, Mother. About our language is really important. We don't want a pile pelala. We got a culture and the lambako ganunakana, ingani yamaba. We got to teach our children, young children. We don't want to lose it. That's why.
Earlier this year, I attended an exhibition about Aranda language in Alice Springs, or Bantwa, as it's called in Aranda. Seeing the exhibition and hearing elders like Margaret Kamara Turner and Kathleen Wallace speak made me even more certain that I want to learn the language.
And also, the language is really important. We got teacher in our school, and there's a lot of language things that anybody could learn. People here, all your kaka, yayas. Come in and learn. There's some people.
Around 2,000 people speak Randa in Alice Springs and surrounding communities. The Aranda people are just one of many Aboriginal communities in Australia. Before colonization, around 700 Indigenous languages were spoken throughout the country. But at different times over the last 20 years, government has banned Aboriginal people from speaking their own languages. The Australian government wanted to create a white nation and wipe out Aboriginal people and their culture. Aranda woman Patricia Ansell Dodds grew up in the 1950s, being told she wasn't allowed to speak her language.
Have you always spoken it since you were born?
I wasn't allowed to because I was part of the stolen generation where they took. My parents put me in a home to get an education, but the home wouldn't let me go back to my parents. My dad had to go to court and get me back. and I wasn't allowed to speak my language or know anything about my culture. That's the way I grew up.
Patricia says Aboriginal people never stopped speaking their languages. She eventually learned language and culture from her elders.
50s,
60s. Yeah. So how did you get your language back?
Quite easy. Everybody talks to me.
Okay.
Yeah. And I also went ceremonies myself to learn my culture.
Right.
And I got very lovely old girls, my aunties, who's taught me a lot of things about my culture here in Alice Springs.
So
she's now working to increase the prominence of Indigenous culture and language in mainstream Australian education. Aboriginal languages aren't taught in Australian schools, but families in Alice usually teach their children.
It's who we are. That language comes first, before any white man's English. That's so important to us even today. Our children's got to learn language and who they are, and culture, and that's what we do.
All right, let's go. Starting with Wada. And what?
Wada.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am a Wada.
Excellent.
Yeah, I am a Urugata.
I've been learning Aranda in a class of about 20 students at the Alice Springs Language Centre.
Yeah, I am a Nana.
Nana.
Arangwa. Mora Antara.
Aranda has sounds that don't exist in English. Some students comment that pronunciation seems to be much easier for me than them. Pronunciation is not that different from Indonesian, my mother tongue. R's are rolled, just like in Indonesian. A few words sound the same, even though they have totally different meanings. Like unta means you in Aranda and camel in Indonesian.
Right now I'm learning Aranda.
Ah, deadly.
Do you like it when people who are not Aranda speakers learn Aranda language? Is that good?
You're in Aranda country. You should learn it and understand us. I walk down the street, they don't talk English to me.
After going to Aranda classes, Aranda. I can see a few lines in Aranda. I wanted to use it to introduce myself to Patricia in her own language.
Yeah.
I was nervous, but she was very nice to me.
Okay. So now I'm going to try and speak Aranda to you.
Go on then.
I hope, be nice to me. I'm just beginning to learn.
Yeah.
So, Wada, Aritnya Cina Dina. Indonesia Apmara la Apmara Arinya?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Kalamara.
Kalamara.
I understand what you were saying about your country.
Yeah.
Your Mura is up that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where you come from.
For Asia Calling, I'm Dina Indra Safitri in Alice Springs, Australia.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm
That's good.
That's good.
Yeah.
Okay.
For this special last edition of Asia Calling, I got in touch with past editors of the program, whose hard work made the show what it is. Here are a few words from Rebecca Henschke, who held the reins for 10 of Asia Calling's 14 years.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Henschke, and I edited Asia Calling for nearly 10 years of my life. Brilliant. Wonderful time and a great privilege. But some of my favourite memories of Asia Calling are off mic when we all got together, the diverse correspondents that really make the programme so special, when they got a chance to come together in Jakarta and people would share their stories, laugh and tease each other. And during those times, Pakistanis and Indians became best friends. We had Cambodians and Thais battling out in karaoke sing-offs. And there was always a great sense of learning from each other. And I think that's one of the most beautiful things about Asia Calling, that it really has been able to tell stories to Asia by Asians, people telling their own story and bringing their unique voice and perspective to a wider audience. It will be greatly missed.
For Indian women who have experienced sexual violence, accessing justice and services is a fraught and troubled process. Police, hospitals and courts subject them to humiliating and degrading conditions, and justice is rarely realised. Asia Calling reporter Jasvinda Sehgal has covered this issue for more than 7 years. For our final episode, he takes a look at what he's witnessed and asked how far India has come. And this feature comes with a warning that some listeners may find the content disturbing.
It's 7.5 years since I first reported for Asia Calling. In that time, I have met some incredibly strong survivors of sexual violence who refuse to be broken by the abuse they have experienced and are fighting for justice despite the odds. One of those women is Bhavari Devi. She was gang-raped in 1992 while campaigning to end child marriage. In 2013, more than 20 years after the incident, she was still fighting for justice.
My fight hasn't come to an end, even after struggling for so many years. My struggle for justice is proof of the government's incompetence.
India's police and court system made the injustice worse, accusing Bhavari of fabricating the incident. Bhavari is just one of a handful of survivors whose stories I have been humbled to share with Asia Calling listeners. Sadly, these crimes are too common, and over the years, I have been covering them. India has seen little improvement. Nationally, incidents of rapes have increased by 12% in the last year. The situation is made worse by the country's high rate of child marriage. Under Indian law, the minimum age of marriage is 21 for men and 18 for women. But in practice, it's another story. 20% of all Indian girls marry before they turn 15. And in my home state of Rajasthan, almost 80% of girls are married under 15 years of age. Searching for solutions, last February, I travelled to Virni Institute in the city of Jodhpur, Rajasthan. The institute is a non-profit boarding school offering an education to child brides from remote villages. I met Dhapu there.
I got married when I was very young. I think it was year 2009. Today, I am 15 years old. I don't remember much about my marriage, but I know that my husband doesn't do anything.
Nearly 2 years later, I recently learned that Dhapu has come a long way since then. Excelling in her studies, she topped her class at Virni Institute. Curious to catch up with her, I returned to Jodhpur. Dhapu has now finished school.
I am continuing with my studies and I'm pursuing graduation in arts. Side by side, I'm also learning computers. I remember what I promised you last time. I will stop child marriages in this country. I will motivate young girls to attain education and disagree to child marriage.
She's also teaching girls like herself at Virni while she completes her studies. Inspired by the change I saw in Dhapu, I decided to visit Bhavari Devi as well to see how time has treated her. But Bhavari has a very different story. She's aged since we last met. Her hair is graying and her face has wrinkles. Her mistreatment compelled the judiciary to provide new definitions for sexual harassment and introduce workplace guidelines to protect women. But it's now 25 years since she was attacked, and Bhavari is still waiting for the court judgment on her appeal.
I haven't given up yet. My fight is continuing and will continue till my death. I'm happy that due to me, many girls are today getting safe working environment. The women are brave enough to speak against the atrocities.
India's justice system owes a lot to women, and there's still a long way to go. A report released by Human Rights Watch last month showed that women who experience sexual violence are routinely harassed by police and terrorized into silence. But Bhavri's ability to keep fighting in the face of persistent injustice gives me hope. Back in my studio, the clock tells me that my time to report on these brave characters is up. Isha Calling is wrapping at the end of 2017. But the people we have brought to your ears and their bravery will live on. Thanks for sharing this time with me, dear listeners. For Isha Calling, I'm Jaswinder Sehgal in Jaipur, India, signing off. Goodbye.
Europe is currently facing a refugee crisis as it struggles to deal with an influx of people fleeing conflict. In 2015 alone, over 160,000 refugees arrived in Sweden. 40,000 of them still don't know whether they'll be allowed to stay in the country. For Afghan asylum seekers arriving in cold Sweden, the transition isn't always straightforward. But as Rick Wasserman reports from Stockholm, a new project is aiming to ease the way.
A tightly packed showroom and workplace in Stockholm is filled with textile designs. Afghan and Swedish patterns combine to make entirely new and unique creations. This is stage one of the Craft and Integration Project, an initiative that is partnering newly arrived young African rug and textile makers with Swedish designers and rug experts.
Young people coming to Sweden who bring a lot of knowledge from their own home countries, and they can also teach us something more about pattern traditions and techniques and things like that.
That's Anna Forsberg, Swedish project director. She sees lots of untapped potential here. Young refugees have brought with them incredible skills in centuries-old Afghan weaving traditions. Anna says this is a great opportunity for artistic development. She's keen to build a two-way cultural exchange and a thriving business.
When so many refugees came to Sweden in 2015, I thought that maybe I should do something here in Sweden as well that connects to textile and design.
35,000 unaccompanied children and adolescents sought asylum in Sweden in 2015. Half of them are young boys from Afghanistan. Many have little formal education, but some of them are talented textile and rug craftsmen.
För här, om du ser, om man trampar här, då lyfter sig ett visst.
Back in her shop, Anna demonstrates how to use a Swedish loom for Abedin Mohammadi. Now 18, Abedin arrived in Sweden 2 years ago. He's been involved in the Craft and Integration Project for 6 months. Back in Afghanistan, Abedin sat by his mother on the kitchen floor and learned to make rugs at the age of 11. He effortlessly gets the hang of the Swedish loom and is confidently weaving within 5 minutes. But he's not convinced this is for him. Making a hand-woven rug is time-consuming.
I know how to make Afghan rugs, and that's pretty boring. I was a child making rugs, which took 3 or 5 months.
But Anna has just ordered a loom from Afghanistan. And when Abedin hears that, he brightens up. It's something he knows about.
I can do that. If they get an Afghan loom, I can teach others.
Stina Laneskog is a textile designer and concept developer, and Anna's partner in the project. She tells me that guys like Abedin might surprise themselves. She's all about working as a team to expand people's creativity.
I can teach them through the design process and being creative that you can do so much more than you know.
Stina tells me they've started the creative process with an experiment. The Swedes drew typical traditional Swedish patterns on paper, the Afghan boys patterns from their traditions. Then they cut them out and mixed them up.
Everyone had their shape, and then we together placed it on this black paper. It's a quick and quite visual way to see how it will become in the end.
At the project showing, I noticed people looking at the Afghan-Swedish textile mix. They looked pleasantly puzzled. I remembered what Stina had said about the piece.
It's a mix that you can't really put your finger on. You know it, but you can't know where from you've seen it. So it's like it's known but unknown at the same time.
That's the whole idea, to create an entirely new design, spanning two very different cultures. With his creations in the public eye, Abedin is looking rather proud.
I'm really happy that we can show people how we work together to make these designs. This feels great.
Far from his family, surrounded by a new language and culture, Abedin has faced plenty of challenges since arriving. Despite all that, he tells me that he hopes he will be allowed to stay.
Sweden is a good country. There's a freedom of movement. I can go to school, I can work. It's good for me here.
From Sweden, this is Rick Wasserman for Asia Calling.
10 years ago, our correspondent in the Philippines, Madonna Virola, produced her first story for Asia Calling. Over the past decade, Madonna has followed the stories of disadvantaged kids as they learn to become their own advocates, fighting for the basic rights they deserve. From Calapan City, Mindoro Island, Madonna Virola looks back over that journey.
Wish you a Merry Christmas. Wish you a Merry Christmas.
It's Christmas in the Philippines, a time that is supposed to be filled with joy, especially for children. But since reporting on kids who are forced to live on the streets, out of poverty or neglect, I know that this can be a very difficult time for some. At this time of year, I often find myself thinking about Pinky, whose incredible story I heard when I met her at local government organization Tambayan Center for Children's Rights in Davao back in 2007. She was 19 years old then and smart looking, breastfeeding her one-year-old son. I was moved by how much she'd been through. She left home at 12 years of age to get away from abusive parents. Quitting school, Pinky started begging on the streets, then got into drugs. When I met her, Pinky had found hope and a second family at Tambayan Center for Children's Rights, a place that gives street kids somewhere safe to hang out and the opportunity to participate in making decisions and policies that affect them. She told me she was selling fried banana to support her son.
Sige, noong 1995, grabe yung phenomenon about buntog.
In 2011, 4 years after that first meeting with Pinky, I again met with the director of Tambayan Center, Edith Casiple. She told me about how the center had gone on to new projects. They were working with kids to write, act in, and produce their own film, Latus.
Naging masamang epekto noon. Actually nga, naging, ano eh.
Annie and Elsie were lead actors in the film, which depicted the harsh realities of physical abuse they have experienced. When I met them, the girls were beaming with pride. They were heading out of the country to receive an award for Best Short Film at New York International Independent Film and Video Festival.
Of course we are happy, but more than the award, we are happy to bring the voices of the street girls. On the roadshows and in every chance, we would do our best to advocate our dream, to stop corporal punishment and start on positive discipline.
Annie, Elsie and other street girls have been on the road with the film, promoting awareness on the rights of children in villages and schools across the country. It's part of a long-running campaign to legislate on ending the corporal punishment of children. Congress passed a bill on the positive and nonviolent treatment of children in January this year. The Senate is yet to pass the bill. Five years after that first film, late last year, Tambayan came up with another award-winning film on juvenile justice. Panon is inspired by true events from 2002, following a bloody clash between all-girl gangs. It highlights the root causes of juvenile crime. Former street kid Laura Parapina played the main character, Kakay. Growing up around gangs, Laura says that the film is powerful as it gave people the chance to start to understand young people who are involved in crime.
They have no idea why we became this way. I hope they won't judge us because it hurts. For young people like us, we take these negative perceptions as a challenge. Show them that they are wrong, that we have a bright future ahead.
These films have opened up a new future for talented girls like Annie, Elsie, and Laura. After all, social worker Carla from Tambayan points out that youth acting out is usually a sign of deeper social problems.
Sinasabi ka namin sa, like, sa Tambayan karon na actually,
as we often say in Tambayan, the way children are only mirrors the bigger problems in society. They are not the reason. They are just victims of our shortcomings as duty bearers and the government.
Those shortcomings are clearer than ever now as Philippines President Duterte pushes ahead in his so-called war on drugs, which has killed up to 60 minors in the last 18 months.
Diyan po ako nakaupo. Nagtitinda ako ng tinapay. Ayun, lumabas siya.
Reporting on that issue, I spoke to the family of 17-year Kian Loy de los Santos, who was murdered in August this year.
Kasi ano niya bukas eh, this. Nay, sabi niya, tatalino kaya ako.
Darkness and poverty hung heavy in their grieving home. I was left with the feeling that justice is now further away than ever. It's heartening to watch kids learn to advocate for their rights and to see civil society groups like Tambayan work hard to support them. But that just makes it hurt more to report that in the last year and a half, Filipino kids are being killed in a war against drugs that has been waged by their own government. Over 10 years of reporting with Asia Calling, I've been inspired by how children can become powerful messengers and advocates. I'll never forget what Pinky said to me 10 years ago.
Dili na mo kinahanglan ng inyong kwarta, pagkaon.
We don't need your money, food, or pity. We need you to listen to us, to trust us.
Pagtagad inyong attention og
Asia Calling is signing off. But I hope you'll find other ways to listen to children who are pushing for a future as bright as they deserve. I'm Madonna Virola in Calapan City for Asia Calling.
And finally, a word from the program's founding editor, Matt Abud. Without his vision, this show would not have been possible.
So I must my favourite moment working on Asia Calling, and there are many. I was there for only about 2 years, but after I left, Asia Calling still reached me several times, far away from Jakarta and years after my time. I remember visiting a radio outfit in Nepal and another in Pakistan. Both times they asked me what I'd done before, and when I mentioned Asia Calling, they said, "We carry that show." And then another time I got into a tuk-tuk in Phnom Penh and there was an Asia Calling sticker on the side. So Asia Calling, you've gone everywhere and everywhere you've been welcome. There's a lot more to say, but for all of us, there's just not enough time to say it. All I'll say is thanks. I'm so glad to have been a small part of your travels.
Our program today was produced in the studios of Radio KBR in Jakarta, Indonesia. You can also find our podcast on iTunes or your podcasting app, and you can search for us on Facebook and Twitter at Asia Calling. That's all for this edition, and it also brings Asia Calling to an end. It's been a true honour to bring these incredible stories from across Asia to your ears, wherever you are. I'm Nicole Kirby. Thanks for listening.